cooperation over chaos. We are all in this together.
The Sustainable Hour.
For green, clean, sustainable Geelong. The Sustainable Hour.
Welcome to the Sustainable Hour in the lead up to NAIDOC Week. For those who need reminding, NAIDOC stands for National Aborigines and Islanders Day Observance Committee. So we like to acknowledge we're on the land of the Wathaurong people. We pay tribute to the elders, past, present, and those that earn that great honour in the future. We're on stolen land, land that was never ceded, always was and always will be First Nations land. Now, in the lead up to NAIDOC Week, it's extremely important that we remind our listeners about the incredible store of ancient wisdom that they've accumulated by nurturing both their land and their communities for millennia before it was stolen. And in that store of ancient wisdom lies so many of the solutions as we face up to the climate crisis.
I didn't think I would even live to hear this kind of news in Australia. Record numbers of bicycle riders in a major Australian city. Record numbers of people moving around on their two wheels. And that's in Sydney. Sydney's Lord Mayor, Clover Moore, is happy and proud, as you can hear here, because she has had a direct stake in this development. She's been pushing for it to happen for more than 20 years.
When I was first came mayor in 2004, there were no cycle lanes. I'm now very proud to tell you that there are 29 kilometres of separated cycle lanes and 66 kilometres of shared paths. This bike lane is the first one I opened in Bourke Street. And, you know, that could have been opened in nuclear reactor. The response from the right-wing media and communities in New South Wales Parliament is extraordinary.
We now have an average of 2,500 bike riders a day. That's children, it's parents with children, it's people on their way to work. It is quite fantastic. This is a remarkable 28% increase in 12 months. From one of our first to one of our newest, the Oxford Street Cycleway, is clocking up more than 4,500 bike trips on peak days, making it our most popular cycling connection.
So join the thousands of others who are taking up cycling today.
That's Sydney's Lord Mayor, Clover Moore, in a Facebook video she's put out where she's bragging about that there's now more than 7,000 people who ride to work on their bicycles in the city centre of Sydney. And that is, honestly, that's the lesson that I've been trying to talk about here in Geelong for more than a decade. Something that we learned in Denmark in history and that we have seen Amsterdam and Paris learn more recently, which is that you have to build the safe infrastructure for the bicycles first and then the cyclist will come. So, councillors here in Geelong who are looking, you know, out their car windows and saying, we can't see anyone using their bikes here in Geelong, so why should we even build a bike path for them? You know, it's the other way around. You have to create a safe bike path network and then the cyclist will come. That's the story that we have now learned from a major Australian city. And that's what we need to understand here in Geelong as well. Because we live in a time now where everyone's talking about energy security and rising fuel prices. And the bicycle is such a good solution to all that tension and pollution which we're feeling. It's in our lungs when we're so dependent on petrol and oil in order to move around. But what we're seeing is governments repeatedly spending billions of taxpayer dollars on trying to shield the car driving consumers from these fossil fuel shocks, from the fact that the Strait of Hormuz has been closed for quite a while now. Government around the world are paying out billions of dollars to support fuel subsidies. In Japan, $20 billion. In Thailand, tens of millions of dollars a day to support fuel subsidies. Around the world, more than 60 countries have introduced what they call emergency measures to prevent fuel price spikes that would trigger economic and social unrest. And that's exactly what dependence looks like. And to make it worse, now we have a figure from the last year that the banks have been paying out $900 billion in financing to fossil fuel companies so that they can build more fossil fuel projects. $900 billion in 1 year. And this at a time when we're seeing climate chaos all around us. I don't get it how these bankers in their suit and ties can go around and justify themselves and come home to their families and talk proudly about what they have done at work today. Financing more climate chaos to the tune of $900 billion. At a time when renewable energy now is the cheapest way to create electricity. No one can blockade the sun. If the banks can find $1 trillion a year to support fossil fuel projects, imagine what we could achieve on this planet if our bankers and the government were firmly directed towards a transition to clean energy and creating the kind of infrastructure in our communities so that we become more resilient and, for instance, begin to use our bicycles again. It's not impossible, and at least now we have Sydney proving that very simple point. It's time for some global news, the Global Outlook. We have Colin Mockett, OAM, ready with the news. And Colin, I hope you have something that's maybe not as grumpy as what I have been coming out with here.
Hello, Mick. Well, not really, because I've got news, basically. It's filled with news. My roundup this week begins in Europe, where it's been well recorded that a severe heat wave, which covered much of the continent for most of last week, is slowly now moving easterly. Last week, it saw temperatures hovering around 40 degrees in France, Spain, and the UK. Now, it's affecting Germany and Poland and presumably moving on to Russia. The phenomenon was and is being driven by a mass of hot air that's moving north from the Sahara. Meteorologists say that the system is creating a so-called heat dome, which traps hot air over Europe, in which, well, Europe was already rated the world's fastest warming continent. In a slice of irony last week, King Charles was affected by the heat when he appeared at a conference at St. James's Palace on London's Climate Change Action Week. In the event, the King described the oppressive temperatures as the new normal. Another speaker at that event, Professor Hayley Fowler of the Centre for Climate and Environmental Resilience at Newcastle University, said that heat waves are becoming more frequent, longer and hotter with climate change as a direct result of the fossil fuels we are releasing as a society. We can expect to have to cope with more and more of these types of events in the years to come, she said. In England, more than 1,000 schools closed due to the heat and many train services were cancelled. At least 18 people died in France, including two children that were left in a hot car. An April report by the World Meteorological Organization found Europe is warming at more than double the global rate. Now, elsewhere in Doha, Qatar, an explosion at a factory injured 54 people and left 18 missing. That's according to the Gulf States Interior Ministry. A technical incident caused the blast in Qatar's Ras Laffan industrial zone, it said in a press release. Authorities were searching for the missing workers. An AFP journalist 20 kilometres away said he saw flames in the night sky and a plume of smoke rising from the area, which is home to the world's largest liquefied natural gas hub. Ras Laffan had already been badly damaged in the US-Iran war, with Iranian strikes targeting the Gulf's energy infrastructure and forcing Qatar to halt its gas production. Qatar Energy said the blast occurred during the startup of operations at the industrial site. Now, it's worth remembering that in Geelong, Viva Energy, which was the former Shell oil refinery, suffered a fire last April, which is still having repercussions. And that's the company that's trying to get permission to store liquefied natural gas in a floating hub at its facility, which is approximately 8 kilometres from the centre, the central business district of Geelong. Now, continuing the subject of LNG, the City of Sydney proposed a gas export tax at the National Assembly of Mayors and Local Councillors last week in Canberra. The motion asked the federal government to impose an export national levy on coal, oil and gas companies, with the money raised given to local councils to use for greenhouse gas reduction measures. It was passed unanimously. Now, Greater Geelong's representatives were there, but nothing has been reported locally. Incidentally, also at the meeting, Sydney Council said that the city was banning gas supplies to all new house building projects. As I said before, Geelong Council was represented there, so the example has been set. We'll see if they were noted in Geelong Council's meetings that are coming in the future. Now to China, which finds itself in a very different position from much of the rest of the world, which is emerging from the war in Iran with depleted oil supplies. The stockpiles held by China's state-owned energy companies remain nearly full. Beijing appears not to have tapped its vast strategic reserves and storage tanks at Chinese refineries. They're brimming with petrol, diesel, and other refined products. China has cut its daily oil imports by roughly a third during the course of the war. The pullback, which was driven largely by higher prices, helped ease some of the upward pressure on global oil markets that were caused by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. China was able to reduce imports sharply because of a broader push to strengthen national self-reliance and improve its ability to withstand supply disruptions. I would expect China's oil companies to continue to be price sensitive and to increase their purchases gradually, said Philip Andrew Speed, who is a longtime China oil specialist at the Oxford Institute of Energy Studies. Chinese companies kept their refineries running throughout the war, he said, by drawing on their extensive stockpiles of crude. But demand in China for petrol, diesel, jet fuel and other refined products appears to have weakened as prices rose and sales of petrol cars have plunged during April and May. At the same time, the Chinese government halted most exports of refined products since the start of the war to ensure adequate domestic supplies. China actually overtook the US in 2024 to become the world's largest oil refiner. And it's typically a major supplier of refined fuels to neighbouring countries, such as Australia. So nowadays, we don't draw our fuel supplies from the Middle East or from America. It's China that is supplying our two refineries. And that piece of mixed news ends my roundup for this week.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
Thanks for that, Colin. Always mixed there. Some good news. The interesting one for me is the LNG and the reference to what Viva has planned for Geelong, for the bay.
Yep. When the Qatar storage system exploded, you could see it 20 k's away. In that case, if the Corio refinery were to come up with a mishap, because it wasn't hit by an explosive, it was simply going through the normal startup procedure at the beginning of a shift. And the workers who were there are all missing. It's a that's the sort of facility that they want to build 8 kilometres from the centre of Geelong.
Yeah, hard to understand. And also, or plus the fact that the emissions that will go out from that facility into the atmosphere.
Exactly. At a time when we're all buying electric vehicles and reducing the need for oil and gas.
Yep, all of that. It just very difficult to understand why that's happening at the same time, why it's allowed to happen, I guess.
As Mick was pointed out earlier, the banks are quite happy to fund the oil companies and the fossil fuel industries, mainly because, well, look, like our politicians, the banks have only got short-term memories. Our politicians don't see beyond a 3-year term. They only see that they need to be re-elected in 3 years, so they don't take long-term views, or rarely do. I mean, I think possibly Bob Hawke and Keating took a couple of long-term views when they thought that they'd got a big enough majority to get through the next election. Certainly, Gough Whitlam took long-term views, but I don't recall any other government that said, hey, we're looking forward to this to do for our grandchildren or for at least the next 10 years. They just don't plan that amount. They only plan for 3 years or 4 years' time.
We tend not to learn from history, the mistakes of history.
Yep, that's a good message to put out at NAIDOC Week.
Exactly. Okay, seeing as we're leading up to NAIDOC Week, which starts next Sunday, it's from July 5 to July 12, we thought it only fitting to have an accomplished First Nations speaker on as our guest, and that is going to be Professor Mark Rose. Mark is the Deputy Vice Chancellor of Indigenous Studies at Deakin University, and many other things, which we'll get to know during the interview. Oh, so welcome to the Sustainable Hour.
Thank you for the invitation. It's great being here. Thank you.
Tell us about your story, your journey so far.
It's a bit of a complex story. My dad was a stolen kid who, after the orphanage, went to the Navy, and a shipmate invited him home to, who was dating my auntie, invited him home for Christmas, had nowhere to go. He met my mum, and the butterflies appeared, the doves and all that, and married, and it was a marriage between a white person and an Aboriginal person, and that was kind of like reconciliation in the very early days. I was the firstborn son, and Dad and Mum wanted to have a conventional marriage. However, they were tracked. My dad was tracked by demons of his upbringing himself. He was, as a stolen kid growing up, taken from his mum at six, he expressed those demons in domestic violence. And I came under the attention of the authorities and about to be put into an orphanage or out of home care. So my white grandparents struck a deal with the Catholic Bishop of Ballarat, which is strange because they were a Presbyterian, that if I changed religion at 8 years of age, where you make those really important ecclesiastical and philosophical decisions, I could go and live in a convent in Ballarat, where I did, and I got raised by 8 nuns. So my education came by stealth. It's and I've got to be honest, it was so boring. The only way to get your head outside the walls of the convent was to read and write. And so I opened up the encyclopedia and read every page I could and wrote everything I could. And so I got an education by stealth rather than by the standard way. I was asked recently about what I knew about equity. And I said, I'm a black kid from Broadmeadows. What else do you need to know? So I went through life at the start, hard way, you know, out of home, But eventually I ended up living with my grandma. My mother died very early, and I then moved into getting a qualification. My mum actually died in the pursuit of me getting an education to keep me in that home. She tried to get a job in a factory in Broadmeadows and took a fit and hit her head and died tragically. So I was determined to get an education. So after I got expelled from a couple of schools and had a bit of a rough I ended up at St. Bernard's in Essendon, where the brothers there in their demeanour sorted me out in 15 minutes, said Toby, who was boss. And then I went on and got year 12, moved into Teachers College, became a teacher. Then since then, I've got another four bits of paper. So I think I've repaid my mum's debt pretty well. So I've been in education, but on a friendly ham cold day, Uncle Banjo Clark got me and said that I had come back to the community to be a bridge between Western education and Indigenous education, and not to take any shortcuts and be awesome and deadly in both, and to be that bridge. So I think in 40 years I've had in I've moved education from being an oppressor for blackfellas into be a liberator, and that's what I work for, with the thought that Aboriginal education is about teaching our kids, but teaching everyone else about Indigenous perspectives.
And in that time, Mark, like you're a pioneer very much in that area, what battles have you had to fight?
And still going. Oh, look, it's landing on the right paradigm and being informed by the ancestors. And I've got the word of the ancestors by being part of VAI, Victorian Aboriginal Education Association, where 33 communities come to one table in Northcote, and they sit down and we advocate for Aboriginal people across the state. I'm voted by those communities to be one of their voices. And I've got five qualifications from a national university, a couple of Victorian universities, a New South Wales and Harvard. And I think I've learnt more from the table with the aunties than I have in those universities. So, except Deakin was, because I work at Deakin, I better say Deakin was, you learn a lot at Deakin, so I want to get the free commercial in, all right? But, the oppression is, I also co-chaired with Auntie Joy Murphy, the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. And been in every jail in the state and saw the sharp edge of the criminal justice system. And when you hug a kid who tried to hang themselves with their T-shirt the night before and you try and give the kid something to hope for, that is where education is important. I wanted to go off and work in justice, be a saviour there. The elders slapped me over the head and said, no, stay in education. Because if we're going to close the gap, it's going to be through education. So it is the silver bullet. It's what we need to make sure happens. So to do it, we've got to be more than invisible and mute in it. So I've worked with the national curriculum, getting the Indigenous stuff in the curriculum. I worked at VCAA, and I've worked in every chance I can get a microphone, including this one today, to talk about that our culture is a real asset for this country, and that I often put up the sign dispossession when I do a keynote, and everyone gives me the Qantas eye roll to say, he's going to bang on about Aboriginal dispossession. But I believe that whitefellas have been dispossessed by our education system, because if you live, love and learn on this country, you don't know the history of it, you've been robbed. So it's a two-way strategy. It's teaching our kids, but it's also teaching about our, and that will change. And the original Royal Commission had that in it.
Mark, in the Sustainable Hour, I sense in the last months there's been a growing sense of despair in a way. We hear more and more speeches about the end of the human race as a species because of AI, or because of climate, or because of nuclear war. And there is, of course, a lot going on in the world. Mm. So there's a new tension in the air. Could the Indigenous worldview help us here?
Look, absolutely, Mick. I believe so. And when you say AI, I presume you're not talking about Aboriginal intelligence, okay? Sorry. I couldn't let that one go by. So, look, we are challenged, but through Aboriginal knowledge, I think it is something that can sort of compete with AI, because through Aboriginal lens, everyone thinks we're going to hand over ancient stories and ancient history, and that certainly is part of it, but it's also about the way you see the world. I walk in two worlds. I walk down Sydney Road out here, and I look on it as a person living in a first world country, and I see it from that perspective, but I also walk down someone who's connected to communities across the nation who are living in third world standards. So I see it two ways. I walk past the trendy, glitzy coffee shops, and that's all very nice, but I can't stop but thinking about our people who are still on Struggle Street. I've just come back from Harvard doing a Black Leadership Program, which is was really good. I was the lightest person in the room. And they actually thought I was in the wrong room, which made me laugh. But they said when I opened my mouth, they knew I was black. And when I told them how my dad, they all identified themselves as being related to slaves. I said, yeah, my dad was a slave. Part of his stolen journey was he was given to farmers in Gippsland to work and locked in a shed at night, so which I regard as that. So, but one of the things I take away from the Black Leadership Program at Harvard was they talked about Rosa Parker and the seats on and how she refused to give her seat. But they said when the mob sat at the back of the bus, at least they were all together, you know. And now that, you know, we've got a rising middle class, you know, how one of my challenges is to make sure that we never rest until people on Struggle Street have the opportunity to get onto Main Street, but we never get seduced by Main Street. We got to work. But to go back to your thing, Indigenous helps you see things different ways. There's a fellow in Adelaide, he's getting on a bit. He was stolen as a kid, taken to Darwin. And when the bombs dropped in Darwin, he got sent back to his family. Now, conventional Australian history says, you know, the Japanese attacked the sovereign people, but taking a kid away from his family and putting him in an orphanage in Darwin was the same. And he says, thank Christ for the Japanese. Now, that has got me in trouble when I've told that story. But it means that person is not completely right, and conventional Australian history is not completely right. So looking at it from two worlds means that you can go to a new common ground place, so you can see things more intensely, and that's what knowledge creation is all about. And that's why the work I've done, I've attracted a bit of criticism from Sky TV, which I hold as being as a badge of honour. First of all, the audience isn't great. It's not like it had a peak distribution audience. But the other thing, that if Andrew Bolt praised me, then I'd be in trouble with my community. So my credibility skyrockets every time he has a go at me. But, you know, they say that the work I do is placating a minority and political correctness. And I go, no. Everyone needs to take their shoes off and feel the cultural heritage of the land they live on. This is your culture. There are parts of the culture I can't share, and that is our deep culture. But most of it, it's also your culture. And, you know, I spoke on that talk that you guys heard me at about the four faces of Australia. We have a colonial history. I'm not going to deny the richness of that. It is rich and valid and important to know. But we geographically, we're Asia and the Pacific. That's got to be part of our identity. Third, we have come from the world's most multicultural countries. And, you know, where you guys live is an example of that, and where I live. And we have the world's oldest continuous culture. And we need to identify ourselves from all those, a mixture of those four faces. And I'm not going to say that we need to be one nation, but we need to be one spirit. So, Pauline, I'm coming after you.
Mark, you, You mentioned earlier on Banjo Clark.
Yeah.
And he obviously had a big influence on you. What other influences have there been on you?
Oh, Tony, absolutely many. The women of Bayi, the old women, many of them have passed, been a great influence. I remember the first time Auntie Mary took me to a ministerial meeting. I thought I was there for my intelligence or good looks or something. I'm about to speak and she taps me on the knee and says, "You're here to listen and learn." So biding your time and waiting for your right time is very important. But Japanaka Errol West, Lionel Bamblett, who has run Bayi for the last 40 years, Geraldine Atkinson, the leaders we have here in Victoria are immense. You got to remember Victoria was first hit colonially, New South Wales, of course, and then my country and later up in the north. So we have resounded, and next week when we move into NAIDOC week, that's a celebration of how far we've come, where that celebration is for everyone. It's the national day that we stop, and I hope we park any notion of guilt and we move to a point of national maturity rather as part of reconciliation. Because being growing up in a convent, reconciliation was all about guilt. And I know that's not a great commodity. Reconciliation should be about national maturity. Say, yeah, bad things that happen, but we are in this country. We deal with those bad things as mature adults and we craft the future. So, Mick, that goes to your question about how Indigenous can be a light on a hill for the future. And I think it can be. Not the dot paintings or the Korean-made boomerangs at the Vic Market, but the true spirit of love, true spirit of humanity, they're the things that we have some, and a sense of humour, of course, they're the things that helped us survive, and that's the thing that will help us through whatever AI throws at us.
That's really great, Mark. And we have Tony every week acknowledging country and giving us a glimpse of that. But I would love if you would dig a little bit deeper in. Now we have the opportunity to hear from you when Tony talks about the wisdom, you know, the ancient wisdom. What is actually, in concrete terms, in a modern world, what is that wisdom? What does it look like?
Well, to me, Mick, that wisdom is pure wisdom. I've worked at universities for over 40 years now, and but I'm a kid from Broadie. I had to work in factories to put myself through the later years of school, and I found the wisest people I ever come across. This might insult my colleagues from over 40 years, but the wisest people I've come across with are people on factory floors and on missions, where the wisdom is just pronounced, and the wisdom is devoid of any, I'm going to say, colonial, and I'm not saying that British colonial, anything that tries to industrialize your mind or spirit. You know, I grew up, you know, my first school was an industrial classroom. And I see how Indigenous perspectives in the curriculum have moved, have aided the system to move from an industrial into a relational form of education. In our way, knowledge transfer, which is ancient wisdom, comes from the fact that rather than the power that's based in Western education, the teacher and the learner, and in a transaction, you ask a question, get an answer. In our way, the teacher and the learner are in constant exchange roles. So the learner becomes the teacher becomes the learner. You share knowledge with respect, and you take that learning to another place. Where blackfellas used to have education, and education Triumphs of the Nomads talked about life before colonisation. They said the average Aboriginal male only had to work 4 hours a day to economically sustain themselves. The rest of the time was in celebration and in education. And I just think about the tax saving if I only worked 4 hours a day. That, I mean, we'd be less taxed. And I'm working a lot more than 4 hours now, so thanks a lot. Colonizers, but having said that, that education was the key, and we went to educate and celebrate on the boundaries, You know, in our boundary road were the demarcation lines that blackfellas weren't allowed across. Every country town's got a boundary road, and the blackfellas kept the other side of it. And then we traditionally would go to those boundary, not boundary road, but boundaries between nations to share knowledge. So moving away from your central paradigm and your sensibility into a common place is so, is the, so ancient knowledge is part of the ancient pedagogy rather than, well, I don't know why I'm using a French term, but the ancient pedagogy is more how knowledge is created and surfaced and shared is the thing that I'm really, and it's done in an egalitarian way where teacher and learner exchange with respect rather than a transactional way.
Country can speak to anyone. It's just, yeah, if they know how to listen.
I stand on the earth. I breathe with the land. The rhythm of its heartbeat weaves in with my own. I give it all the time it needs.
Slow down to the pace of your heartbeat. Tum-tumpa, your heartbeat.
The treaty begins when truth is spoken. Healing begins when heart is named. Water will guide, fire will teach.
Listen.
The stars will sing when we learn to listen. We sang the rain, and the rain came. We danced the land, and the land moved. Our sacred fire never dies. We'll wait for you to slow down. Sit down and learn to listen. The treaty begins when truth is spoken.
This modern world is very fast.
Healing begins when heart is named.
Listen.
Water will guide, fire will teach.
Listen.
The stars will sing when you learn to listen. We are the river, we are the land. The eagle watches, the whale sings. We don't own these stories, they flow through us. Every rock is a page of a living law. Every tide a verse of an ancient truth. Song lines have been drowned in pipelines, kinship traded for control. But in a world that forgets, we remember. We carry the culture with us. And we are still here, walking.
We're not waiting for the government.
Still here, protecting.
To listen to us anymore.
Protecting what protects us.
We're just doing it.
So our future will be strong and safe. Learning takes time. Learn to listen.
Our country is our identity. It's part of who we are. And, you know, it should be at the root of all other decisions made.
There's so much in the Western culture. If we look at, for instance, the way men have been the key players for centuries. They have been the ones out there with their ships conquering and colonizing, and they've been also in the home in charge and actually quite dominating to their women and so on. How was it in the old days in the Aboriginal community? Was that the same, or was it different with the male-female balance and also the relationship to nature?
Well, the relationship to nature is really important. And of course, my immediate experience is being born 12 years to the end of the Aborigines Protection Act, where Aboriginal manhood was still under attack, and leading up to the intervention again, it was still under attack. So we go back, we hear stories about beyond that, the notion of clan groups and the notion of extended families come to play in a very big way. So I think the structure would have been good, but some of it is only not because our knowledge was destroyed and our language was destroyed. Some of that has been interpreted or re-engineered and reinterpreted. So I can't empirically speak about what. All I know that, you know, I've been around Aboriginal men, and there was a woman I know, an academic, who did a great thing when Howard had the intervention and there was attack on Aboriginal manhood then. She wrote to every one of the men in her life that she knew and told how much she appreciated that manhood. And we had men's business and women's business. So in that men's business, we would get together and we would talk about health issues and, you know, share knowledge. So we did go to gender ways. I've been a leadership program in another state that I'm involved with. When I suggested we go to men's and women's business, I got challenged on whether some people don't identify as men or women. And I go, yeah. And I'm sure there's leadership programs for them too. But in our way, men's and women's business accommodate all, everyone. So, and the peak thing about Aboriginality is inclusion. So we do include it. But I've got to be blunt. If you go to some communities across the nation, we still bear the scars of, you know, genocide, colonization. And that's, I won't paint it as all rosy. I've been there, and I've been in every jail in the state. Joy and I handed down a report in Parliament, there was a quote that was attributed to me. I dedicated to the men, women and kids who find the surrealism of the criminal justice system better than the realism of their own life. So when you talk about men's, that's been number one attack. If you want to eradicate a people, attack families, attack economics, attack culture, attack language. So the, you know, dismantle, destroy, diminish, all those D words happen to us. So I'm not making excuses. I'm just proud of being Aboriginal and proud how far we've come. And I believe that, you know, our sovereignty, and I'm not talking about a political sovereignty, but our importance as a people will come back to the point. I'm working for sovereignty, but I'm not waiting for the government to give it to me. Sovereignty is something that you are and you believe in and you grasp. It's something that you don't have to march in the street for, something that you believe. That is your ancestral mandate. So that's what I would say, yeah.
I find that very interesting. Even, you know, I'm not in any way close to being indigenous, except maybe there's a bit of Viking in me.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But, you know, I have been thinking a lot about what men will do if they were to transform into an ecological future where humanity actually saves themselves and we don't destroy our planet until we can't live here any longer. And what would that new type of being masculine look like? Maybe that word sovereign could be a new place to go. Because what I'm talking about is that men need to sort of off-learn being dominating, off-learned being these old traits from 10,000 years of male domination. But what do we put in its place?
Well, I think someone who identity and sovereignty, as you said, is very important. But Mick, as you were talking, it reminded me that when I work with that leadership group, and I've worked with 10 of them now over 10 years in New South Wales, that I go in and talk about that the moment they walked into a classroom, they were on in a leadership program, an industrial leadership program where hierarchy was reinforced and where control, command and control was reinforced. So a sovereign person recognises the colonising encumbrance in their life and works beyond that. So I could bleat about sovereignty and the colonisation, but I'm just going to get on with the job and making sure people emancipate themselves from the neo-colonial encumbrances that we all carry around with. And it's in our language, it's in our media, it's in our political system, and there's a decay in the political bodies at the moment, both left and right, and people are looking for a new way. And I'm not going to suggest anarchy, because I have done that as a young person, but what I am suggesting is that this is let's read the landscape, you know, and let's take our shoes off and feel Mother Earth and say what is important to us, you know. We get drawn in, you know, and The Voice was a classic. It got hijacked by the binary, you're either yes or no, you know. And I know good people who voted no, and I know good people who voted yes. So, you know, when we get dragged into that binary mindset, that's what we need to liberate ourselves from. You know, we're not Liberal, we're not Labor. You know, I've worked the back channels of politics for the last 40 years, and some of the best people I've been at my 60th birthday party, I had Liberal and Labor politicians come. So if we can't operate like that, then we're losing the plot, you know. This is the country that decided that national capital would be halfway between Canberra and halfway between Sydney and Melbourne. Where's that logic gone now? That kind of common sense logic, you know. We argue every, you know, about Invasion Day and Australia Day. We need a national day to celebrate. Let's land on something, for God's sake, you know. Where's that Australian logic that we had, you know? So this is a time for us to really get into our roots. But as an immature nation, we get very Jungian, and we don't define ourselves who we are but by who we're not, you know. If you're in that orange group that's emerging at the moment, you're not migrants and you're not Aboriginal and not pregnant mothers. But if both sides, both extremes have really thing. But defining ourselves who we are rather than who we're not is important. And that's what maturity is. And, you know, I've worked across the world with communities, you know, Sami, where you come from, Mick, Malaysia, Native American, and the ones that really are sustainable are the ones who define themselves who they are. And what we need to do, you know, modern day Australian history is exactly that, modern. You know, we're ancient, but we're new. And what we need to say, you know, move away from who we're not to who we are.
That's how deep we could get in 1 hour, one sustainable hour today that went into the Aboriginal wisdom. Thank you so much, Mark, for taking us there. And I couldn't agree more with everything that you have said. There's a lot to explore still, because it also asks questions to us, you know, who are we as Australians? And I speak now as an Australian, because I do have an Australian passport, but I also have my Danish background. So to find that new way where we all come together, that is an incredible and an exciting project that we just haven't even started, have we?
No, it's the journey that we're on, and it's a very important journey.
Now, we've come to the B section, Mark, where we always ask our guests, what will we B be, or what do you want us to be, or the listeners to be?
A word in our in the Aboriginal is deadly, be deadly. But I did say that to a group of medical students, and apparently that wasn't the best thing to say. But seeing that you brought up AI and knowledge and ancient knowledge and modern, be curious. Just be curious and park your tacit assumptions and be curious and courageous and go to a new place.
This land has held stories for longer than memory. Hands in the soil, whispers to frogs, songs carried by the riverbanks. Tiddalik drank the water dry, so the women followed springs, not with force, but with patience, planting as they went, reweaving the land with love as method, listening as law. We've never been free, never more connected, so let's not wait for permission or perfect conditions. Let's move, let's grow, let's get our hands in it.
Those willing to pick up shovels,
pick up your shovel,
embrace.
This is the time, call the elders, we're ready to listen.
There's a lot stopping us in a lot of ways, but we've also never been freer, we've never been more connected.
It wasn't policy, it wasn't profit, it was being, being with, being for, belonging to. We don't need another slogan, we need a place to stand barefoot. We need purpose with dirt under its nails. We need to build what feels like home. We're not lacking a plan, we're lacking the will. We've never been free, no perfect conditions. Let's move, let's grow, let's get our hands in it. Pick up your shovel, this is the time, call the elders, we're ready to listen.
You know, this is the time. Those willing to pick up shovels and rakes and manure and mulch and seeds, this is the time.
Don't tell me you love this country as long as you still poison her veins. You don't get to farm without family, without connection, without conscience, without consequence. We watch the banks erode, and still we wrap the truth in story so it wouldn't be lost. An army not of soldiers, but of water carriers, seed planters, those who look at a damaged field and see a forest of healing and hope. We've never been free, never more connected, so let's not wait for permission or perfect conditions. Let's move, let's grow, let's get our hands in it. Shovel, this is the time, call the elders, we're ready to listen. Listen and learn.
This is not sacrifice, it's sacred participation. Water clean enough to drink, that's the promise. Pick up a shovel, this is our moment. This is the time,
this is the time.
The time is right, boys, like now's the time.